You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Corner House podcast. You'll hear all about our up-and-coming show, New Cartographers, from the exhibition curators Joe and Ed. I'll be joined by my regular contributor from Salford University, Andy Willis, and also our programme manager, Rachel Haywood, to talk about two films that open this week. We'll also hear from Andrew Gilmore. He's the artist showcasing his work on the wall of our cafe and bar this month. And of course, we will have our recommendation of the week and our What's On guide. So let's start things off with our film focus. This week, we're looking at Essential Killing and also Oranges and Sunshine. So let's start with Essential Killing first. This is a film about a man who goes on the run from US troops in an unidentified, somewhere in the Middle East perhaps, country. He escapes from custody after he's transferred to another location, which is somewhere cold and snowy. And it's about his sort of journey, if you like, and his very, very difficult descent into, I don't want to spoil the film, but what we could describe as kind of animal behaviour. So first off, Andy, tell us a bit about the director of this film.
Well, Jerzy Skolimowski was one of the kind of Polish New Wave from the 1960s. He began working as a scriptwriter with Andrzej Wajda, the famous Polish director. And Wajda encouraged him to go to the Wujcz Film School, which is a very famous film school in Poland, which has produced a number of really important Polish filmmakers. After making a couple of feature films in Poland, he made a film in France, then he went back to Poland. He made a film called Hands Up, which fell foul of the authorities, and he was sent into exile effectively. And that began a kind of career of making films all over Europe with bits of money from here, there and everywhere. He's probably, I think, best known for audiences in the UK for two films he made, one in the late 70s, one in the early 80s. One called Shout, The Shout with Alan Bates. And probably, I think, certainly for me, his most famous film is Moonlighting, which was a film he made with Jeremy Irons, which was one of the first films funded by Channel 4. And it was almost a direct response to martial law being established in Poland in 1981. And they started shooting the film very quickly. And it was one of the really successful Channel 4 releases when it first came out in 1982. And perhaps for more recent audiences, you might recognise him from Eastern Promises, the David Cronenberg film, where he played Naomi Watts' Russian uncle. So he's kind of recognisable to different generations for different things, I think.
Just thinking about the film, I thought it was really strong. Haven't seen a film like this for a while, so I thought it was quite refreshing. I really got into it. It's quite short running time as well, which always works very well for me. What did you think, Andy?
Yeah, I think it was very taut. You know, that was the kind of word that came into my head after I'd watched it. It's clearly not that expensive a film, but it keeps full of energy and it keeps going and driving along. Very clear kind of story. I mean, there were some things about it I wasn't so keen on. I mean, I like films that are kind of around political issues, like this one, to be maybe a bit more overtly political. But I think, to be honest, most people probably would prefer the film as it is rather than the way I would like it. Because it doesn't really tell you whether the central character is a fighter in some kind of a resistance group or whether he's been in the Taliban or where he's actually from. So there's a kind of vagueness about it, which I thought, well, no, I'd like to know where he's actually from and who he's actually fighting with, if he's fighting at all.
But is that does not make it quite political in a sense? I think the way the director is trying not to be political for me makes it overtly political because he really tries to hide the, you know, actually identifying this man. But then he's in what is looks very much like Afghanistan or somewhere like that. Even more specific, it looks like Afghanistan than Iraq, say. The troops, there's US troops, they're speaking American. Then he moves to a place which looks like Poland. Well, people speak Polish, so it's got to be Poland. And it's very much inspired by a secret CIA base that was in Poland and people were taken there. So in some ways, I think it's really political. Most people just assume all of that knowledge in a sense. And then what happens to him? Is he any better off in either location or in any scenario situation? And what has he done anyway? And that's the thing. There's always those two sides to every story in a sense. We think we're right and someone else is wrong. But is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right there. I mean, it is a film that kind of denies any concrete location. But there's enough there, I think, for you to actually actually, like you say, actually realise where the location is and what the issues and the current sort of debates about transferring prisoners from one country to another to torture them, which is what they've done. The fact that, again, not spoiling anything, the fact that when he's transported, he's wearing the kind of iconic orange garb which people associate with Guantanamo. Yeah. So all the things are there, I agree. But I think for it to be absolutely critical of the American and the alliance sort of transferring of prisoners in that way, I'd have liked just a little bit more anchored story for me.
And the lead character is rather strange. It's played by Vincent Gallo, who you might remember was quite a darling on the film festival and indie scene with controversial films like Brown Bunny. And he's sort of gone missing for the last few years, but he's very much an American actor. However, in this role, he's had quite a transformation. He's barely recognisable. He doesn't actually speak throughout the film. What did you make of his performance?
Well, I thought it was a good performance in that sense. You know, it's one. I did think it's one of those performances that you would struggle not to do well in. You know, there's no dialogue to deliver, and we don't know much about the character. And Vincent Gallo, being an actor who's got a big reputation for his method, you know, he's one of that tradition of method actors, immersing himself in the role. The fact that the film doesn't really give you that much of a background to the character is quite an interesting role for someone like that to have to play, because of course they're looking for all the backstory to the character to bring into their performance. But yet there's not really any backstory to this character. So it must have been quite a challenge. I mean, there's always the classic stories of method acting, and this film's no exception. So the directors talked about him complaining in one scene that there wasn't enough live ants for him to eat, in another scene that he eats a live fish that's sort of flapping around in his hands. So all of those kind of crazy method acting stories are there in this film as well. But I do think the kind of intensity of the film works with this kind of actor, who sometimes I think is overly intense in films that don't really demand it. But in this film, that intensity, I think, is very, very right for the part.
This film is it's definitely an art house film. It's not going to appeal, you know, really widely to everyone. Who do you think should come, Andy?
Well, you know, I think in a sense it's very action driven, and so I think it might appeal to people who might look at it on the surface and think, oh, you know, it's a kind of a bleak story. It kind of isn't anchored in any reality, like I was saying before. But I think if you like a kind of action film, you know, basically the character lands in a place he's not sure about and he's pursued and he's trying to survive. And that kind of fits with lots of sort of action narrative. So I think if you like that kind of more oblique art house film, it gives you something for that. But if you like a slightly more mainstream action-driven story, then it's got that as well. But it's not a simple, you know, it's not a Hollywood film of that type. But I think there's something there for people like me who like that kind of film as well.
Great, thank you, Andy. Now, over to Rachel for our second release this Friday. It's called Oranges and Sunshine. Tell us a little bit about the film, Rachel.
Oranges and Sunshine is a true story. It's based on a memoir written by a social worker, Margaret Humphreys. The book's called Empty Cradles. And the film tells the story of how in 1986, Margaret was accosted, really, after a therapy session one evening by a woman who has come from Australia looking for her family in the UK. And this woman's story, which is quite an emotional story, kickstarts a whole search that Margaret Humphreys goes on with her husband and ultimately sort of for the rest of her career. The woman explains to Margaret that she, as a child, was deported. She was sent away from the UK, told that her parents, particularly that her mother was dead, that she wasn't wanted, and that she could have a new home in Australia. And so from this initial encounter, the social worker Margaret goes off on a search and starts to uncover masses and masses of similar stories. And so she goes over to Australia to help lots of these children who are now adults find their families and for some of the people, reunite them with their parents.
Now, this film, it's a British film. I've said for a while that I think we need to replace Ken Loach and Mike Leigh. We need a new generation, if you like, of younger, socially engaged filmmakers. But I didn't mean literally a new generation. Now, this is directed by Jim Loach, who is Ken's son. How did he do, Rachel?
He does a good job. He has made a transition from working in TV, so most notably he's worked on Shameless. But I think that there are certain elements of the film which are very much TV. You can tell what his past is, and I think you can also tell that this is very much a first feature, that it is the first step in a transition to a feature film career. He's also taken a lot of cues from his dad. In fact, I think every write-up he's Jim Loach, bracket, son of Ken. So it's very, very similar. So he does really draw on those social issues and really taking that as his cue. So it would be interesting to see what his next moves are, see if he moves away from that or if he continues in the same vein.
So back to the film itself, Oranges and Sunshine. How did you rate it and who do you think should watch it?
I think there's a large audience in terms of Ken Loach fans will not be disappointed. Like I just said, the social issue aspect of it is very much going to draw people in, the historical aspect. And also looking to uncover stories, because although I was aware of this history, this very recent history, I think it is an important story to be told. So there's a big audience out there in terms of recent true historical stories. How I rated it, I think it's a very decent first feature. And in fact, I think I probably enjoyed this one much more than Ken Loach's recent film, Root Irish.
It's all right. I'm sure Ken won't mind. He will take one for his son, I'm sure. Well, thank you for that, Rachel. So Jerzy Skolimowski's Essential Killing is screening tomorrow, Friday the 1st of April. All the times are on our website. And then that was Oranges and Sunshine. That's by Jim, son of Ken Loach. And that's also screening from Friday the 1st of April. And you've guessed it, check the times on our website and why not book ahead whilst you're there. Okay, it's time for our hotly anticipated quickfire round. I'm going to put Andy and Rachel on their toes by asking them quickly to name three best something films, a bit like blankety blank, so I will insert something. They will have to answer very quickly. But what we would like you to do is tweet your selections as well. So after every podcast, tweet or send in your quickfire rounds and maybe we'll be able to add your suggestions in future weeks. Okay, so best fruit film. I'm going to go for Fruit Chan's Durian Durian, which is about that exotic but smelly fruit, an independent Hong Kong film. Over to Rachel.
For me, it would have to be Clockwork Orange. Myself and Andy have been talking about this one a lot lately because it's the 40th anniversary of the film next year, 2012.
Andy?
Well, carrying on that theme then of Clockwork Orange, of course, when we were thinking about Clockwork Orange, the film I came across was Clockwork Banana, a lesser-known French masterpiece, some say, of the erotic film genre, shall we say. I can remember seeing it on at the pictures in the ABC, I think, in Chester when I was a teenager, but I wasn't old enough to go and see it. Maybe doing this work, I will get to see it.
Okay, second quickfire. Your film, your best film with virtually no dialogue that's not in the silent era. I'm going to pick an old classic, Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. I'm sure a lot of people have seen that, the old 50s film with Jacques Tati, a bit like an precursor to Mr. Bean, if you like, where he goes on holiday and it's very much slapstick, very funny comedy.
My choice would be The Illusionist, which we showed last year. And it actually relates really closely to your choice as well, because it's based on a Tati script. And the main character, the magician's even called the Tati Chef as well. So, yeah, that would be my choice, and I think it's a good link.
Andy?
Keeping in the comedy vein, then I think The Plank, the British comedy, I'm not even sure if it's feature length, with all the likes of Harry Seacombe and Eric Sykes and everybody in that. If I recall, that hasn't got much dialogue, if any. The characters just go rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb all the way through.
And this one is really, really tricky. It's your best Vincent Gallo film. I'm going to go back to Andy.
Well, that is tricky, because there isn't many, is there, if any? I'll go right back to the beginning of the career, I think. Is it Buffalo 66, the heist film, where he's in amongst some other great actors like William Forsythe, and so he doesn't look so bad as usual. Maybe he hasn't learnt all those twitches of his later career.
Rachel?
Well, hopefully this time next week we'll be saying Essential Killing, but to hedge for bets a little bit, I'd opt for Claire Denis' film, which we screened last year, Nanette and Bonnie.
I'd like to say Brown Bunny, but I actually recall it as being fairly awful, so I'm just going to chicken out and say Essential Killing, because I have seen it already, so it definitely counts. And anyway, I'm the quizmaster, so I decide. Thank you.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Corner House, Manchester.
Now it's time for our What's On section. Now, Andy's still here with me, and he's a leading member of the Chinese Film Forum UK, and we have some events coming up held by that group. Andy, tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, Chinese Film Forum UK is a gathering of like-minded film enthusiasts, people from Corner House, people from Salford University, MMU, Manchester University, Confucius Institute, Chinese Art Centre, all people from all around the city. And our aim is to put on some Chinese-themed films. They don't have to be from China. And that leads us into this special event that's going on next week. We've got a talk about Anna May Wong, the Chinese-American actress who was very, very big star in the silent era, but found it very difficult to get parts that she thought stretched her or that were worthy. And that led to her coming over to the UK. So we've got a screening alongside that talk. The talk is on April the 5th at 5 till 6 about Anna May Wong's career and Asian-American actors and actresses generally, followed by a screening of the 1929 British silent film Piccadilly. Well, that film was shot silent and with sound, but we'll be showing the silent version. As I say, she felt she wasn't getting the roles that she was due, so she came over to the UK, and everyone really has a consensus that Piccadilly is probably her greatest hour on screen, so it's quite a rare chance to see that film on the big screen, so I'm really, really looking forward to that. And then linked to that, the week after, on April the 12th, there's a documentary about Asian American actors and actresses and the whole kind of problems that people have had getting their experiences onto the American screen. That's called Hollywood Chinese. And then that is also showing with a very, very rare screening of what I think is the earliest known example of Chinese-American film, a film called The Curse of Quan Quan, which was made between 1916 and 1917 and has been restored by an American archivist called Arthur Dong. So that is a really rare opportunity. So two linked events. All the details are on the website on April the 5th and on April the 12th. So I would really encourage people to come along to those.
Okay, and elsewhere in the city, one of our favourite festivals launches its programme this week. That's Future Everything. So Future Everything itself takes place mid-May, but we're going to the VIP launch to find out what's in their programme, and I'm sure it'll be all on the website and available to book. We'll come back to talk about Future Everything in future weeks. Next Thursday, the 7th of April, make sure you join us for the preview of our new exhibition. It's called New Cartographers, Algeria, France and UK, and it's a very timely look at the relationships between those three countries. The preview itself is 6 till 9pm. It's drop-in any time. Join us for a glass of wine. And there's also several events that are free, but you should pre-book a ticket on our website. We have a seminar on the Friday and a discussion with the artists and curators on the Saturday. So again, have a look and sign up now. And we don't just have the exhibitions that are in our galleries. We do a host of other art projects. And one of those is the fabulous Corner House Projects, which is a really good platform for regional artists to get their work shown in the bar or cafe. They can really take full advantage of Corner House location and its nearly 500,000 footfall to show their work to a wide variety of people for around 3 weeks to a month. It could be a single artist work. It could be a group exhibition. It's usually 2D media. And anyone in the Northwest can submit their work, so do send us a CV, a proposal, and some images. This month, Andrew Gilmore is in the spotlight, and he's exhibiting his work on the walls in our cafe. Our digital producer, Sarah, caught up with him earlier this week.
Hi, I'm Andrew Gilmore. I'm an artist and writer based in Manchester. I lived here all my life.
Andrew, for those that are unfamiliar with your work, how would you describe it?
Painting and drawing, initially. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on in there, with elements of collage. Recently I've started to kind of devour my own work in collage and reproduce it as I was doing with the mass media images, like I used to be stealing stuff from magazines and that, but I started to phase it out as a natural progression, as a natural growth, and plus it was becoming a copyright nightmare as well. I mean, some joke was bound to try and sue me eventually, so you know, I had to evolve.
And so talk us through some of the pieces that are in the bar at Corner House at the moment.
Well, it's quite eclectic. My work's always been like that. I mean, it's just about playing with imagery, found imagery and my own imagery, and there's a lot of stuff going on in there, like I say. There's a lot of slogans and fractured elements because it's inspired by the mass media, among other things. So there's some of it's profound, some of it's irreverent. I like to play with that. I like to juggle things around and kind of not trick people, not deceive them, but kind of mess about with semantics and have little stories as you're going through the paintings, little stories kind of evolve and fall apart. And with titles as well, I don't like to just describe what the painting is in a way that, you know, you get those boring titles where it's just, you know, nude reclining and it is a nude reclining. So I like to take the painting down a different road with titles, or sometimes play little games with the viewer. So it just expands and makes it more interesting instead of being just a dogmatic, boring catalogue way of cataloguing the work.
And have you always been interested in, you know, like the newspapers, magazines, flyers, that mass-produced imagery that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's quite indicative of the times we live in, and you know, we're kind of bombarded with it every day, and it becomes this kind of soup. What I love about having my work here in the Corner House is that you can see some from the road, so it's a nice touch. It's like the icing on the cake, because the work's coming full circle and it'll be seeping into people's subconscious, the way the stuff that inspires it, like the posters and billboards we see all around us. So I'm really thrilled about that. That's kind of a nice thing that I didn't plan. It's just kind of happened.
So tell us about, are there any other artists that inspire your work?
Most obviously, the progression in the work, you can see it becoming more inspired by Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat. There's a bit of abstract expressionism in there, and pop art. Recently, my work's changed again. I try to stand still, but I get itchy feet, and I have to try on different, you know, suits, as it were. So my work's inspired by graphic designers and such now. An artist called Ashley Wood, who is a natural progression, a natural evolution to an artist called Dave McKean, who's done a lot of work that was inspired by fine art and the comic book medium. So Ashley Wood is my major inspiration at the moment. But for the paintings here at the Corner House, it's definitely Basquiat.
Okay, and talk us through, for other maybe aspiring artists like yourselves, how easy was the process to kind of submit your work here to Corner House and then get it on the walls of the bar?
I'd applied a few years ago, actually, with my portrait work, because I was doing portraits then. And it just wasn't, you know, what you wanted at that time. And then I did this new batch of work, and it was fairly easy. Once it was in the pipeline, it was quite easy. You just, put together a portfolio, and you get lots of rejections. This is going out to every artist. You're going to get lots of rejections. You just got to keep going, okay? It's about how much rejection you can take, If you're going to quit after a few, yeah, it wasn't for you.
And how do you feel? You talked briefly earlier about exposing your work to a broader audience out on the, Oxford Road. Mm. We've got a busy street there. How important for you is it to showcase your work in a place like Corner House?
Well, I'm quite glad I'm on the ground and first floor, because I didn't want it squirreled away upstairs, because, I want people to see it. And, it's still being on those two floors. It still has that environment where they can contemplate it and look at it, which is what fine art is about. It's about taking it out of context and analysing it. So it's really important. And like I said, it's a real kind of cherry on the cake having it in a position where it's becoming, part of all the other images. So it's playing the game, really, becoming, part of the bombardment of media.
I believe you're bringing out a children's picture book later on in the year. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, again, that looks absolutely nothing like the work I'm doing at the moment or what's on the walls in the Corner House. It's about 10 years old, so it's long overdue for publication. That's a children's picture book, but it works on other levels. Like teenagers and adults will enjoy it because there's other things going on in there. On the surface, it's just kind of like a fast-paced, colourful story, but it's also a fable. The work in there is acrylic paintings on canvas. And that's inspired by Tim Burton's kind of spidery drawings and Clive Barker's works, his paintings for the Aberrat books, which not a lot of people know about, which is a shame because they're really beautiful and they're really kind of got great scope on them. So I'm looking forward to that coming out in July.
Cool. So thanks for coming in today, Andrew. You can see Andrew's work in the ground floor and first floor bar up until the 18th of April. So I'd highly recommend you come and check it out.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
So, as I said earlier, we've got our major new exhibition opening next week. It's called New Cartographers, Algeria, France, UK. It's one of our major group exhibitions that's part of a strand of our work that looks at socio-political issues. So you'll remember that we had contemporary art Iraq last year, and we're going to continue the focus on the Middle East and North Africa into next year. Our programme coordinator, Christina, caught up with Joe and Ed, the curators, as they were installing the work this week.
Could you just give us an overview of New Cartographies and what the exhibition is about?
Well, first of all, the exhibition stems from a research project that's funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And a wider research project looks at how the relationship between France and Algeria has been represented visually since the start of the War of Independence, which was 1954. But the exhibition breaks new ground in the sense that it takes us beyond that to look at contemporary connections between not just France and Algeria, but also between the UK, France and Algeria as well, through the work of 10 contemporary established and emerging artists.
I think the importance of situating France and Algeria in a broader context, political and social context, is one of the key things we wanted to do with this exhibition, because we feel that the relationship between France and Algeria, Algeria, one of France's most important colonies up until 1962, is very important in the history of those two countries. But what's increasingly interesting and important is the wider role played by Algeria and also post-colonial countries in this kind of broader international arena and broader political debates. And that's one of the things that I think some of the, quite a few of the pieces in the show actually explore, how Algeria, what role it plays in the contemporary world more generally.
So what kind of work are we expecting to see in the gallery?
We've drawn together 10 artists from Algeria, France and the UK, and we've really brought together quite a range of media. So we've got photography-based work, we've got video-based work, and we've got some photography-based installation work, which we think is going to be quite spectacular, particularly in Gallery 3. So we've got a range of media, visual media, exploring these questions. We've also got some different styles of photography in particular. We've got some quite classic documentary photography, black and white, kind of quite moody atmospheric things. One of the key pieces of the show is the one that opens in Gallery 1, which is an installation by John Perivolaris. This was a commission piece from us, and we asked John to undertake a journey between Manchester and Algeria last summer, June, July 2010, for him to explore some of the links that exist between France and Algeria, but also between the UK and France and Algeria. John's got a very good observer's eye, and I think the range of photos that he's brought to the show and which mark some of the stages of the journey really bring out some very interesting and distinctive features about what it is that is interesting about the two countries and their relationship and their place in the wider world.
How relevant is New Cartography's Algeria, France, UK today?
Well, it's extremely relevant. We would say that, wouldn't we? But, I mean, even in the kind of genesis of the show and the kind of journey that you know, we've been on, putting it together, we've discovered many aspects that have brought home to us actually how relevant, you know, this whole area is. You know, needless to say, the fact that one of the Algeria-based artists has been, you know, refused a visa to attend the show, brought home to us, you know, the contemporary realities of migration that, you know, the show actually engages with explicitly, and in fact Zinedine Bessai's own work, you know, engages with too. So I think that very fact that one of the artists was not allowed to visit the UK for 4 days to attend the opening of the show shows very much how relevant the issues the show deals with, you know, are.
Thanks for answering some questions. Joe and Ed will be back next week to talk a bit more about the exhibition, along with a couple of the artists who'll be coming in next week to install the show, so stay tuned.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
Now it's time for our staff recommendation of the week. This week we've got our Young People's producer, Marisa Draper, to tell us about something interesting going on in the city.
So today, which is the 31st, of March, apparently there is a big bear being carved out of ice in Piccadilly Gardens. Slightly strange, you might think, but apparently this is being done to celebrate the opening of a new gallery within Manchester Museum. It's a Living Worlds Gallery, and that opens to the public on the 14th of April. So as part of that, they've commissioned somebody called Mark Corrath to create this sculpture out of ice. It'll be a bear, and the ice has been frozen around a bronze impression of a bear's skeleton, so it will take about 5 days apparently to melt away, obviously depending on our lovely weather, and at the end of it we'll get to see this bronze impression. So get down there. I've not seen it myself, but I've seen everyone on Twitter kind of going on about it, so yeah, I'll probably be popping down at some point in the near future, and that's my recommendation.
Thank you, Marisa. And now that's all we've got time for today, so thank you to Andy, thank you to Rachel and everyone else that's helped in the production of this podcast. Don't forget, all our times and all the further information is on our website, www.cornerhouse.org. Follow us on Twitter, join us on Facebook, and also check out our blog. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast.